Welcome to episode 25 of the Language Neuroscience Podcast. I'm Stephen Wilson. Thank you for listening. It's been a while since I recorded an episode. Sorry for the delay, but I'm very excited to be back to the podcast and happy to say that the first episode back is a really great one. I've got some more guests lined up too, so there shouldn't be such a long wait for the next episodes. To make a long story short, the reason I didn't record any episodes lately is that I moved back to Australia with my family at the start of this year. There's been a lot going on. I moved to the US when I was 23 with nothing but two suitcases, and it was easy. I thought nothing of it. But moving with my whole family at this stage of life is a whole other thing. We're now living in Brisbane, which is where my parents and many extended family members live, and it's lovely to see them all the time, instead of having to wait years at a time. I've started a new position at the University of Queensland, where I'm in the School of Health and Rehabilitation Sciences. There are great new colleagues here who I'm enjoying getting to know, and I'm looking forward to developing some new lines of research. I need to build up a new lab, so if you're a potential grad student or postdoc, please don't hesitate to get in touch. I really miss my friends and colleagues at Vanderbilt, which was an awesome place to work, but fortunately, we're continuing to collaborate on our aphasia recovery project, even though I'm living on the other side of the world. Okay, on to the podcast. My guest today is Alex Huth, Assistant Professor of Neuroscience and Computer Science at the University of Texas, Austin. Alex uses functional imaging and advanced computational methods to model how the brain processes language and represents meaning. He's done a series of extremely elegant studies over the last 10 or so years, and we're going to talk about a few of the highlights, including a really cool study that is just about to come out in Nature Neuroscience with first author Jerry Tang. By the time you hear this, it will be out. Okay, let's get to it. Hi, Alex. How are you today?
Hey, Stephen, I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on your podcast.
Yeah, well, thanks very much for joining me. And I'm pretty sure that we've never met before, right?
I don't think so, no.
Yeah. I mean, do you go to a lot of conferences?
I mean, you know, in the before times, I went to like SFN frequently and SNL every now and then.
Okay.
But yeah, yeah. I'm hoping to start going back again, but yeah.
Yeah, I also haven't been to many for a few years, and when I did, it would mostly be SNL, and usually only when it was in the US, so I'm not very much out and about, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so where are you joining me from today?
Yeah, I'm in Austin, Texas.
Yeah.
Sunny Austin.
It looks nice. I can see outside your window, and it looks like a beautiful day.
It is. Spring is sprung. Allergies are in the air, you know?
Right. Yeah, and I'm now in Brisbane, Australia, and it's also a beautiful day here, first thing in the morning, and it's nice. Apparently fall, which we call autumn. I'm just trying to get my head back around the Aussie lingo, but, you know, all the seasons are pretty much the same here.
Oh, lovely. That's how I like it. I don't know. I grew up in Southern California. That's
all right,
par for the course there.
So you don't know anything about weather.
I've learned a little bit in Texas, which kind of surprised me, but yeah.
Yeah, cool. I always like to kind of start talking with people by learning about like how they came to be the kind of scientist that they are and like basically childhood interests and how that led you to where you are. So, you know, were you a nerdy kid? What were you into when you were a kid?
A very nerdy kid. I don't know. That's how it goes, right? I was very into Star Trek. I was like really, really into Star Trek, The Next Generation. That was my jam. Especially Data. Like I loved Data. He was just, I don't know, a weird robot hero to me. So, I don't know. I got this like kind of fascination with artificial intelligence, based on that. And I don't know, just generally liking science fiction. But when I was, starting college, AI was kind of in a slump. It was in a bad period. This is like the early 2000s.
Okay.
So, I sort of looked around and it seemed like one of the really interesting ways forward in, you know, if we want to build machines that think like humans is to, figure out how humans think. So I started getting into neuroscience. I remember the first neuroscience talk I ever saw was, Mark Konishi, describing the barn owl, auditory localization circuit. And I was like, this is really cool. I want to do this kind of stuff. So, I started sort of getting interested in neuroscience through that.
Okay. So you went to undergrad at Caltech, is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Okay. And is that kind of close to where you're from? Like you mentioned Southern California.
Yeah. Yeah. So I grew up a little bit north of Los Angeles in a little town called Ojai, California.
All right. Yeah. My wife is from Thousand Oaks. So I know that area. Yeah.
Right next door. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So Pasadena was like a little ways down the road and I don't know, Caltech is a good school. I was excited to go there. So yeah, I like started doing neuroscience stuff, but I really kind of started enjoying things when I started doing research. So that was in Christoph Koch's lab when he was still at Caltech. I was working with blind subjects. We were looking at auditory motion perception in blind subjects, which was exciting and interesting, and ended up being like a JNeuro paper in 2008, something like that. And then from there, there was one real moment that was like a sort of eye opener, like changed things for me, was Jack Gallant, who I ended up doing my PhD with. He came to Caltech and he gave a talk, and it was about vision. It was about like V2. You know, what does V2 do? How do we model V2? But the thing that he really talked about was this approach of just record what the neurons do when they see natural stimuli, right? Just show images. Just show images that actually are things that, you know, an animal might see. Record what the neurons do and then build models from that. Try to figure out, you know, if you get thousands of these images, thousands of, you know, responses from these neurons, can you figure out like, what is it about the image that makes this neuron fire? And something about like, just that perspective of doing things, not from the very like controlled experiment, kind of, deductive, approach, but doing this inductive thing where you just kind of lean on computational modeling and say like, I'm going to let a model figure out like what this neuron is actually doing. I just became like insanely excited about this. So, when I was, applying to grad schools, Berkeley and working with Jack was like one of my kind of top interests.
Okay. So, you know, I definitely have noticed that like you've leaned in very much to natural stimuli throughout your career. You would have a paper on it with Liberty Hamilton, specifically about that. But like, so that was really actually a driving force for you from the very beginning, right? And so, you know, what did you see as the advantages, and was there anything that you were worried about giving up as in like kind of, well, you weren't really getting away from controlled designs because you never did controlled designs, but like, I'm sure you knew about the, you know, the literature, and were you worried about giving up anything as you moved in this new direction?
Yeah. No, certainly. I had been doing like actually visual like psychophysics experiments mostly. I was like designing and running little psychophysics experiments while I was in Christoph's lab. So I'd been like kind of familiar with this and learning how to do things there. But just the idea of this natural stimulus thing where it's like the work of doing the science of like figuring out what's going on, you kind of move it from one place to another, right? You move it from the experimental design kind of phase into this modeling phase. And I just really liked that idea. Of course, you know, there are definitely things we give up, right? So there are correlations in natural stimuli, and those are hard to break. And, you know, sometimes you kind of can't tell like what is causing actually this response. And sometimes you have to go in and like do kind of focused experiments to break those correlations and then figure out like what is actually responsible for, you know, what this brain area is doing or what this neuron is doing or whatever. But overall, this idea of, just kind of like replacing this elaborate, like, you know, let's test one little thing at a time with the big picture, like, let's just see how the whole system works and then, you know, kind of let it sort itself out as we figure out how to model it. I just really like resonated with me. I love that idea.
Yeah. Well, it's worked out really well. So let's kind of give our listeners a more concrete idea about what you're talking about when you're talking about these experiments using natural stimuli. And like I told you on email, I was thinking we could kind of go through some of your work chronologically, because I do think each big paper kind of builds on the previous ones in a very satisfying way. So we might start with a paper which appears to be your dissertation research, which is 2012, published in Neuron. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And it's called "A Continuous Semantic Space Describes the Representation of Thousands of Object and Action Categories Across the Human Brain." It's not quite a language paper, but that's okay. Like it's semantics, and that's close enough for me.
Yeah. So I can give you kind of the backstory of this. So when I joined Jack's lab, this is like 2009. I thought I was going to be doing vision. I was interested in vision. I was like, this is where the cool stuff is happening, is the vision world. I thought, like, you know, the interesting problem is this mid-level vision problem. Like, we know how V1 works. We know, you know, that there's FFA and PPA and whatever the high-level visual areas, but like, what's happening in the middle? Like, what are the transformations that actually get us there? But Jack sat me down, like, when I joined the lab. This was just after the Tom Mitchell's science paper had come out, this 2008 paper where they were building these encoding models in a lot of the same ways that we do for words. So they had shown people individual words, and then they had these feature vectors for the words, and they were, you know, predicting the brain responses to the words and so on. And I think, you know, Jack had seen this and was really excited by this. And so he sat me down when I first joined the lab, and he said, you know, I have a plan for you. I want you to work on language. And I said, like, I don't know anything about language. Like, I've never done this before. And he said, okay, so we have a good collaborator, Tom Griffiths. He knows a lot about language. You're going to learn the stuff and you're going to do it. And I said, okay, fine, let's do it. So, you know, we started kind of going down that road and like designing language experiments, which were a lot crummier than what we ended up eventually publishing. But sort of along that road, we started, you know, trying to build models of word representation. That was kind of what we were interested in at the time, was like,
yep,
these really like word embedding models. And it was, you know, early days of word embedding models. We were mostly focused on things like LSA, you know, it's latent semantic analysis, which is
okay,
like 1989 or something like this, right? Sort of classic word embedding models. So you know, I was building these models, I was collecting corpora of text and, you know, doing this kind of early computational linguistic stuff. And then, you know, we didn't have good fMRI data for that yet. So and we thought, like, how do I actually test this? How do I figure out if it's actually working? And what we did have in the lab was a lot of data from people watching movies. Data from people like looking at images.
Yep.
So we just thought, like, hey, let's try this out on somebody watching a movie. Like, you know, if we're on looking at images, right? We have some labels of the things that are in these images. Let's just plug that into a word embedding model and see if it works. And it worked really well, it turned out. It was quite effective. And so this kind of led me down this alternate path of like fitting these kinds of models. We ended up actually kind of changing things up quite a bit. Instead of word embeddings, we were using these WordNet labels, which are...
Yeah. I mean, because in that first paper, it's not trivial how you would go from these movies that you had people watching, these little movie clips, to, you know, your semantic representations, right? I mean, that's actually not trivial. Can you sort of describe how that works, just so that people can understand the paper?
Yeah. So the experiment was, we had people watch a little more than 2 hours of natural video, natural movies. This was a stimulus set that I actually didn't design. This was designed by Shinji Nishimoto, who had a fantastic paper in 2011 that was decoding video from human visual cortex, which is just an incredibly impressive thing. Even whatever it is, like 12 years later, I'm blown away by that work. And a lot of like his ideas from that have carried forward into our current work.
Right.
But so we had this data around, we just didn't know like what was actually happening in these movies, right? We needed to know like, you know, what is this a movie of? Like, so we can, you know, use these techniques.
Yeah, I mean, as a human, you know what it's a movie of, but you need to quantify it for your models, right?
exactly. Yeah, we need to turn this into numbers so that we can model it, right? So, you know, I started exploring, like, you know, do I use Mechanical Turk to label this or something? And we tried that, and it ended up being just kind of messy, and the results were not great. So I ended up doing a thing, which I tell my students this story all the time, because I think it's just an example of, like, just be a little bit less lazy than the next person and things can work out for you. I just sat down and labeled all the movies myself. So it took, I don't know, like 2 months or something, just like spend an hour or two a day, like labeling, you know, a few dozen seconds of movie or something like this. Like, so we labeled it, you know, 1 second at a time. Each second we like wrote down, I wrote down like, what are all the things? And like, are there verbs that are happening? Are there actions that are happening? So this process took a while, but
I'm pretty
confident in the labels because I did them, and I know that they're like consistent across the whole set, unlike the Mechanical Turk labels, which were very, again, like messy in a lot of ways. So once we had these labels, then we could very easily kind of fit these models. So, you know, we can convert, you know, if a scene has like a dog in it, we know that there's a dog there. We can convert that into some numerical vector that says like, what is a dog? And then we can fit these regression models that predict the fMRI data, predict how the brain responds based on these vectors of like semantic information.
Yeah. Okay. Just quick meta point. Like, I really hear you about like the time, the laboriousness, right? When I read the paper, I was like, that must have taken a really long time. I wonder, did he do that himself or did he like browbeat somebody into doing it? But it's so true, right? You have to, especially like early in your career, like you really just sometimes have to like to suck it up and do something really time consuming. And I've done that a bunch when I was, you know, earlier in my career. And now like whenever I give my students some awful task, I sort of have this like, you know, pocket full of things that I can tell them, well, you know, when I was a kid, I did this. I carried my father to school on my back through the snow. So you can, you know, transcribe this speech sample.
Exactly. And I don't, there is a lot of value in that. I think like a lot of people just see something hard and like give up or like, you know, can I find some shortcut around this? And if you just sit down and do it oftentimes.
Yeah. Sometimes you just need to do it.
Yeah.
So you've got the movies, you've kind of like, you know, you've labeled them with words as to what's in them. And then you mentioned you, from those words, you get vectors of numbers that are going to describe the meaning of the word. So like, that's what, you know, that's kind of an encoding, like a, what do you call it?
An encoding model. Yeah.
An encoding model. So can you describe how you get that vector of numbers? Like for those who have not seen the approach before?
Yeah. For this paper, we used WordNet, which some people might be familiar with. It's essentially a dictionary. So we have these, you know, unique entries that are tied to the definition of like this entry, which is nice because then this disambiguates like words that have different senses, right? So dog can be a verb, it can be a noun. There's like 10 different senses of dog, the noun, but you know, I know that like dog.n.01 is the word net label for like, this is a, you know, a mammal of the canid family, whatever.
Yep.
So with WordNet, you get that kind of sort of detail, but then you also get information about what kind of thing that is. So WordNet contains a lot of these hyponymy relationships. So like a dog is a canid. A canid is a carnivore. A carnivore is a placental mammal. A placental mammal is a vertebrate, etc. So you have this kind of chain. That's sort of an easy one because it's taxonomy, but it covers all kinds of things, right? I don't know how many like tens of thousands of definitions there are in WordNet, but it's very expansive. So we could label all these things in WordNet, and then we could use actually that information to help us out a little bit. So what we did is, you know, one kind of simple thing you could do is say, just, I don't know, there were 1300 something unique labels in this movie data set. So let's just convert each frame or each second of the movie into like a length 1300 vector that is zeros, except for the places that correspond to like the categories that are present.
Right. So it's either dog or not dog.
Right. So there'd be a one if there's a dog in the scene and zero if there's not. So that's fine. That's an okay model. It turns out it doesn't work terribly well as a model because it doesn't have a lot of information that is actually quite important, right? So like say there's a dog in some scenes and a wolf in other scenes, right? If you just had these as like 1-0 labels, then your model has no idea that like a dog is like a wolf, right? You have to separately fit weights for, you know, how does the brain respond to dog and how does the brain respond to wolf? Which is kind of inefficient, but also it means that you can't like generalize to new categories that you didn't see, right? So if your training data contains a dog, but then you're testing this model on some video that contains a wolf, if you had no wolf training data, you just wouldn't be able to predict that at all.
Right.
But if your model knew that like a wolf is actually a lot like a dog, these are very similar things, then maybe you could guess that the response to wolf should be like dog, and then everything works better.
Mm-hmm.
So, what we did in this model is essentially just add these hypernyms. So we extended it from like the 1300 categories that were actually labeled to 1705 categories, I think, that were the full set, which included all the hypernyms of the labels that we had. So instead of you know, if the scene just had a dog in it, instead of just having one sort of indicator that there's a dog there, there would also be an indicator that there's a canine, that there's a you know, carnivore, a mammal.
Yeah.
Which, like, later we kind of actually worked out what this kind of meant mathematically in an interesting way, in that this really actually kind of represented, we could think of it as like a prior on the weights in the model, that would kind of push closer together weights for categories that are related. So it would kind of enforce that, like, the response to dog and wolf should be similar.
Okay. Which is, yeah, by having a common covariate really with them, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it turns out that model works much better. Like, it's much better at, like, predicting brain responses. So this is another critical part of the kind of natural stimulus paradigm, I think, is that you know, we build these models on natural stimuli, and then we also test them by predicting brain responses to, like, new natural stimuli, which I think, you know, I argue this strongly in some papers. I think this is really kind of a gold standard for testing theories of how the brain does things, right? It's like, we want to understand how the brain processes, you know, visual information or how it processes language. Let's just record, like, what happens when the brain is processing language. And then let's say, how well can we predict that?
Yeah.
Right? How well can we, you know, guess how the brain is going to respond to this thing? So,
it's nice how quantifiable it is, right? You know, whether you're understanding things or not.
Yeah. It gives you a score to just, like, make it go up, right? You can keep tweaking things and make that.
And I think that's what we're going to see as we discuss some of these papers today. It's like your models keep on getting more and more sophisticated, right? And so this is a pretty old school model at this point. This paper is 10 years old, maybe even older when you actually did the work. We've come a long way since then. But I did want to start here because a lot of the concepts kind of run through it all, and just the models get better.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I think they get better in a way that is quantifiable to us.
Yeah.
Which I think is very nice, because it's easy in a lot of ways, you know, to think of, like, you know, for studying some psychological phenomenon, we can say, like, here's a simple model, and then we're going to elaborate and elaborate and elaborate that model. And maybe it predicts, like, other, you know, little things about it, but it becomes unwieldy in a way. It's like, it's unclear with, like, big elaborate models, how well do they actually explain things? Whereas here we have this, like, quantifiable metric, right? We can say, like, it makes the number go up. It makes our prediction of how the brain actually responds to real things that we care about better.
Yeah. Very cool. Okay. So you've kind of explained how you get the numbers, how you turn the movies into numbers that represent their meaning. Now, I can't remember if you said you have 2 hours of movies in this study. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. That's
and right. And you don't have a huge number of participants. I think you have 5 participants. Of whom one is yourself, and you've got another couple of co-authors in there. I noticed there is a participant called JG, but on careful examination, it is not Jack Gallant.
It is not. That's right.
did you try to get him into the scanner to be one of the?
He was scanned for some things, but not for this one.
Okay. Yeah. So a substitute JG in his place.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah, kind of the classic psychophysics tradition of, you know, small numbers of participants, most of whom are the authors of the study, because that's who will tolerate 2 hours
basically
of scanning.
Yeah, and yeah.
2 hours might seem like a lot, but it's going to get more. So anyway, how many explanatory variables do you end up having at the end of the day when you fit that to your data? Like, it must be well over 1,000, right?
Yeah, yeah. So the feature space in that paper, I think it was 1,705 parameters. And then we also do a thing where, you know, if you're trying to predict how the brain is responding to this, like, ongoing natural movie, you also need to capture the hemodynamic response function, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the standard way to do this is just to, like, convolve your design matrix, which would be, you know, the 1,700 dimensional thing, with a canonical HRF. But, you know, a thing that they had found in Jack's lab, you know, before I even got there, this is really, I think, work by Kendrick Kay that showed this very nicely. That doesn't actually work terribly well, especially if you have this opportunity to, like, measure how well are you actually doing, like, how well are you predicting? And it turns out that, using the canonical HRF is kind of bad, or you're leaving a lot of, like, variance on the table. So, we use this approach, the finite impulse response, model, where essentially, we fit separate weights for each feature for several different delays. So we're kind of fitting a little HRF for each feature. So you know, for the dog feature, we get a little HRF and so on.
Okay, you have four different delays, you like 2 seconds each. So you're basically modeling the first 8 seconds and letting the response take any shape it does in that time.
Exactly. I think in this paper, we actually used three delays. It was like 4, 6, and 8 seconds.
Okay.
We expanded to four delays later for language because language actually has earlier kind of takeoff, it turns out. Visual cortex has a slow HRF, which, it's kind of weird when you think about it because the canonical HRF is built based on like V1. And it turns out V1 doesn't have like the most standard HRF across the brain. It's quite different. Auditory cortex has like a very short HRF in comparison. Motor cortex has a different sort of style of HRF.
Yeah.
So there's different things happening everywhere. But you know, using this kind of method, it blows up your parameter space.
Yeah, it's going to multiply it by three in this case.
Exactly. Yeah. 1705 times three features.
Yeah.
But it still works better than using the canonical HRF because you're capturing all these sort of details in the hemodynamic responses across the brain.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to talk about HRFs. I could talk about HRFs for like an hour with you, but I probably we should focus on language. The relevant thing here is that it turns what's already a large number of explanatory variables into a very large number. So are there issues with fitting linear models that have 5,000 explanatory variables, or do you have enough data to do that?
So there are definitely issues. There's always issues. There's always issues in fitting linear models. I don't know. This is, in the time that I was in Jack's lab, I'd say maybe a good like 80% of everyone's time and effort was devoted to this question of like, how do we fit better linear models? Like that was really central to like everything we did. It's weird because like that didn't look like the scientific output, right? It's like, we didn't publish a lot of papers about like, how do you fit these linear models? It just ended up being like a tool that we used. But that was a massive amount of the like intellectual effort there. It was just like, how do we do this well? We have to use regularized linear regression. That's like a super important tool. There were a lot of different like styles of this that were used for different projects in the lab. It turned out for sort of vision models, if you're modeling like visual cortex, then one style of model works terrifically well, this like sparse linear regression, because visual cortex responses are actually kind of sparse. They only care about like one little part of the visual field. Whereas for these like semantic models that I was using, that actually didn't work that well, which was surprising. And the thing that worked really well was ridge regression. And that's been kind of the mainstay of everything we do since mm-hmm. then. So this is L2 regularized regression. I don't know. We can talk about it. I love ridge regression.
It's definitely interesting. Yeah, no, I think that the big picture point is clear. And it's just an interesting general point of just how much of science often is just these behind the scenes details that make or break the papers. And when you read the paper, it just basically says we did L2 regularized regression. And what the reader doesn't always know is that like, that was a year of pain to get to that, or, so that's very Absolutely. Interesting. It's just always fascinating to hear about the process behind these papers. Cause like, I think a good paper, like just reads like that was the most obvious thing in the world to do, but like sometimes it wasn't obvious at all. So you fit models, at every voxel, you fit these models that have 5,000 explanatory variables based on these semantic feature representation and flexible HRF. And then what you find, is that different parts of the brain or different voxels have very different response profiles. And you demonstrate this in the paper with a voxel from the PPA, or the, it stands for parahippocampal place area, and another voxel in the precuneus. Can you kind of talk about the different responses that you saw across the brain?
Yeah. So I think that's kind of the second stage of this style of like encoding model science is, we can fit the models, we can test them, we see they work well. And then we can say like, what is it that's actually causing some piece of brain to activate, right? Like what are the features that are important to this, this voxel, this chunk of brain? One thing we can do is just like look at the weights. Right, so we just pick out a voxel and say, like, what do the weights look like? It has high weights for, in the PPA case, I don't have it in front of me, but it's like high weights for buildings and cars. So it likes sort of seeing things that are constructed in motion. Whereas the precuneus voxel, I think, is much more selective for like other people and animals and this kind of thing. So you know, we can do that. We can look in detail, quite a bit of detail at like individual voxels and say like, you know, what does this voxel care about? What does this voxel care about? But that has its limits. There's like a lot of numbers to look at there, and there's a lot of voxels in the brain, right? And this is, you know, we're not doing this on groups of subjects. We're fitting this separately on each individual subject. That's a lot of voxels to look at. So what we did instead was we kind of tried to summarize the weights by reducing their dimensionality. So we just applied like a standard sort of machine learning data mining technique, principal components analysis, use that to squeeze down these things from 1,705 weights we average across the HRF delays down to just three or four dimensions and say like, you know, what are the major kind of axes of variation across the brain, right? If we had to summarize what these voxels are doing in like three or four numbers, what does that say?
Mm-hmm. And those top three or four dimensions capture kind of interpretable aspects of semantics, right? In this paper, at least.
Interpretable-ish. So like then interpreting those ends up being a whole thing. Like that's difficult and like contentious and so I mean, they do separate some things that are sort of natural and we would expect to see. So like animate versus inanimate categories is a big distinction. Essentially human versus non-human. I think like sort of buildings, artifacts, and vehicles versus other things. So these are the kind of like major dimensions that we see pop out. And one thing we did in that paper was also like we compared these dimensions to... you know, there's been a lot of literature in the you know, the field of people looking at ventral temporal cortex of like what are the major dimensions of representation. So one of those was animacy. So this is from Jim Haxby's lab. Andy Connolly had this great work showing that like there seems to be this like gradient of animacy across ventral temporal cortex, and that came out like very naturally in our data. Mm-hmm. Like we really saw that there was like this beautiful animacy kind of dimension. Other things we found like less evidence for, but we still got to kind of explore that space.
Yeah, like my notes of it, and this is just like my notes that I read it, which is a couple of weeks ago or whatever. I wrote: first component, motion/animacy. Second component, social interaction. Third component, civilization versus nature. Fourth component, biological versus non-biological. So like you said, I'm not like trying to hold you to those, but I think it's kind of interesting that like these are the big, big organizing principles. It kind of like a bit of it's a window into like what's really important for humans, right? Like these are the major axes on which the semantic system is, you know, has the most variance. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah. And that's something that I really like about this approach too, right? Is that like, we're not taking those things as given. No. We're not baking those things into our experimental design. We're just saying like, watch a bunch of videos and then let's see what falls out, right? Like what are the differences across the brain? What are the major distinctions the brain makes?
Yeah. And the brain did, and you were surprised in this paper that the brain didn't care about object size, which actually maybe is not that surprising. Like maybe it shouldn't, right?
I don't know, maybe it shouldn't. That's one of these like sort of proposals for what was a major organizing kind of feature of visual cortex was object size. And we found less evidence for that. I don't know what the current kind of status of that theory is.
Yeah, but, me neither. Yeah. Okay, so like just kind of big picture wise, like, you know, what can you describe like which brain areas were responsive to these semantic distinctions in this study?
Yeah, so big picture, you know, what we saw here was that this sort of semantic selectivity for visual concepts was not isolated to just like these few areas in higher visual cortex, which is kind of the picture that we had loosely from a lot of studies that came before this, right? So we knew about like the place selective areas, we knew about face selective areas, body selective areas, and those were kind of the major sets of things that we knew about.
Yeah.
And those turn out to be, quite important and very clearly like come out in this kind of data. But we think of those more as like, peaks in a terrain, right? So there's this actually complicated terrain kind of all across higher visual cortex. Like if you go outside of retinotopic visual cortex, there's kind of a band of cortex that stretches around that, like all the way around the brain. And all across this band, we see selectivity for something, for like some kind of, you know, specific semantic features. So that's kind of the majority of where this happens, is sort of in this band, like around higher visual cortex. We also see quite a bit of stuff happening. You know, there's kind of these weird like spears that come out of visual cortex. So up to the PSTS, there's some, you know, visual representations up there, through the intraparietal sulcus, and sort of onto the medial surface of the cortex. There's another kind of spear of visual cortex, and then up in prefrontal cortex, there's also like a few selected areas that are quite visually selective. So there's some face patches, and like the frontal eye field are, you know, very visually responsive.
It's funny, so you're calling them visual, but like, don't you think they're semantic?
Yes. because all of these things, you know, we've seen later are like, you know, they don't really care that it's vision per se. That's not quite true. So FEF does care that it's vision. FEF kind of only responds to, you know, to visual stuff.
Frontal eye field, yeah.
Yeah. Intraparietal sulcus, it's quite visual. So that's kind of a gap in the other maps that we see. But yeah, a lot of the stuff in higher visual cortex, especially, you know, we call it visual cortex because that's how we were studying it. But it turns out that overlaps like very heavily with you know, other modalities of,
yeah,
of representation.
Cool. Yeah, I want to talk more about like the anatomy of the areas that you find, but maybe best in the context of the next paper where I think it comes out more clearly. So should we move on to that next one now?
Sure thing.
So this is your 2016 Nature paper. And, you know, I've always noticed that like Nature doesn't publish fMRI, you know, like Science does, that what they did, you know, like back in the heyday of fMRI where, you know, every man and his dog was getting, you know, these high profile papers. It was only Science that was buying the Kool-Aid, you know. Nature, the only fMRI papers they ever published was like, I'm blanking on the one, Logothetis et al, where, you know, they actually do simultaneous fMRI and, you know, direct cortical recording. I mean, that was good enough for Nature, but generally speaking, Nature does not publish fMRI. But
so, yeah,
congratulations.
We were pleased to punch for this to happen.
But yeah, if any paper was going to be in Nature, I think this is a worthy one.
Thank you.
It
was a big effort. Yeah,
definitely. So in this one, like it's definitely a bit more language than the other one. So, cause the stimuli are language, right? So can you tell us about the stimuli?
Yeah. So, this was, you know, what I said before is like, you know, I kind of started off, you know, we wanted to do language, we wanted to do encoding models for language. I did this kind of offshoot project into Vision that was kind of using our models, that we were designing to study language to do Vision. But at the same time we were sort of continuing down this path of doing language. So, you know, we'd done some tests with other kinds of stimuli. So we tried things like having people read sentences with RSVP, you know, just like one word at a time. That didn't work terribly well. It turns out it does work fine. We were just kind of doing things poorly at the time. We were worried about timing. So we were worried about, you know, like when do the words happen? My co-author, Wendy Deheer, and I, we really like developed this experiment together. We spent a long time doing things like, you know, recording ourselves speaking stories at a rate of one word per second, which is the most mind-bendingly like awful thing to listen to. Like imagine it's shocking. Like just how boring, like verging on like painfully boring that is. It's awful.
It teaches us something about prosody, the fact that that's not going to work.
Right. So, we did these like, you know, one word per second experiments, terrible. But it was controlled in a sense that, you know, we knew when every word happened. And then Wendy, said, you know, why don't we just try something like actually natural? She'd been listening a lot to The Moth, which is a, you know, storytelling podcast and radio show. And she said, why don't we try listening to one of these stories? And I was like, you know, how are we going to deal with the timing? And she said, oh, this is a thing that, you know, linguists have totally figured out. You know, you transcribe it, use this forced aligner, you can figure out when each word is fine. And I was like, okay, if you know how to do that, that's great. So we did it. We collected some data with, I think just the two of us listening to these moth stories. In fact, just like one moth story to start. And it just immediately worked extremely well. We got beautiful signal quality, like all across the brain. We do a sort of pretest on a lot of the stimuli that we use, which is we just have someone listen to the same stimulus multiple times, right? We just like have this person listen to the same story twice, and then for each voxel,
intra-subject correlation, huh?
Intra-subject, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's not inter-subject correlation, intra-subject. So just within each voxel, like how correlated are the responses? Kind of a measure of like how big are the functional signals that we're getting, right?
Mm-hmm.
We'd done that for these like, you know, one word per second stimuli. It was god awful. And then we did it for a moth story and it was just beautiful. Like but the whole brain mm-hmm. was
but you don't know respond. Yet. Sorry, you don't know yet what's driving that, right? If you
right.
I mean, it could be anything. It could be something really trivial like, you know, auditory amplitude, right? But it's
right,
not.
Which,
it's not, but you don't know yet,
that
right?
was actually what Wendy was interested in. So she was a grad student in Frederick Tunison's lab. They study sort of low-level auditory processing, mostly in songbirds, but now also in fMRI. So Wendy was interested in sort of building these acoustic models, like spectral representation models of auditory cortex. So she was totally fine with that. Yeah, but we didn't know, why this activation was happening. So we got these maps. We were like, this is beautiful. Let's keep doing this. So we just collected a bunch of data of us at first just listening to these moth stories, listening to lots of moth stories. We collected, I think it was like two sessions of, five stories each of listening to these moth stories. We went through this, the transcription and alignment process, which I, learned eventually. So then, we had this information about like every single word in the stories and exactly when all those words were spoken, right? So we had this aligned transcript. And then we could start to do kind of interesting things, right? So we also had phonetic transcripts. We could build phonetic models. So just say, our feature space is the English phonemes. what does each voxel respond to in phoneme space? We could build acoustic models with this data. So, get sound spectra for the stories and then use that to model the brain data. And we could get these semantic models, right? So this is using these, again, kind of primitive word embedding models, latent semantic analysis, and so on. And those worked very well across like a big chunk of brain. And that was very exciting. That actually happened, I think, in like 2012. So that was around the time that the earlier like movie paper was coming out when we had these first results that were showing that this was really starting to work and starting to show us something.
Okay. So in this case, you're not having to go through and laboriously identify what's in the, like, cause previously you were looking at the movies and saying, what is there semantically, right? Like, whereas here you're just actually taking the words that are transcribable and then deriving semantic representations for the words automatically from that point, right? Like,
yeah.
So a lot less labor intensive.
Definitely. And I mean, the transcription process, I think, is the most similar to like the labeling process,
yeah, but it turns out transcription is much more deterministic. Yeah.
Yeah. It's much easier, much easier. No judgment calls to be made really. You can listen to something at half speed if you're pretty good and just bang it out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah. And it works a lot better, right? Like the compared to the previous paper, like the semantic maps here are just a lot more clear and expansive, right?
Yeah, yeah. So where the the visual stimuli really elicited these responses, like in this band around visual cortex, these story stimuli, we got stuff everywhere. We got stuff everywhere. It was all over sort of temporoparietal association cortex, all the way from like ventral temporal cortex, up through sort of lateral parietal cortex and down into the precuneus. And then also all across prefrontal cortex, we found this, strong, predictable responses to language with these semantic features. So this, it just worked really well kind of quickly. One thing at this point that we were like kind of freaked out by was we just didn't find any asymmetry in terms of model performance between the two hemispheres. It was like the right hemisphere was responding just as much, or, our models were working just as well in the right hemisphere as in the left hemisphere.
So when you're talking about working, I really want to talk about this because it's super interesting, but mm-hmm. I just want to make sure we understand what we're saying exactly. So when you say working well, are you talking about predicting held out data, or are you just talking about having a lot of variance by semantics?
Yes. Yes. Sorry. Predicting held out data. Right.
Okay. So you're listening to 2 hours of stories and then predicting another 10 minutes
Right.
What the brain should look like on a story that the model hasn't seen before. And many voxels in the brain are really good at this, but not all. Then you make these maps of like, where are the voxels that are good at predicting where you're able to predict? Because forgive me for breaking it down like really simply, but like,
no, thank you.
If a voxel is not able to predict held out data, that probably means it doesn't have semantic representations, because if it doesn't have semantic representation, then it wouldn't be able to, because why would it? But if it does, then it should, right? So it's kind of a really good window into like where in the brain there are semantic representations.
Exactly. That's kind of you just verbalized one of the core kind of tenets of this kind of encoding model style science, which is that if you can predict what a voxel is doing on held out data using some feature space, then we take that as evidence that that voxel's representation is tied up to that feature space, that it's related to that feature space in some way. And of course, there can be spurious correlations, and we see this, and you know, we can try to explain those away in various ways. But basically, that's the kind of inference that we try to make.
Right. Yeah.
So we found that like right hemisphere, we could predict right hemisphere just as well as we could predict left hemisphere. There was no real asymmetry in prediction there. I remember showing this to another grad student when I first found this, and he said, nobody's going to believe you in the language world. Like, this is too weird. If you don't find left lateralization, like, nobody's going to believe you. Which, I don't know, has ended up being very interesting in terms of how people think about lateralization. Liberty Hamilton, who's both a longtime collaborator of mine and I'm married to, she also, this is kind of a bugaboo that we have together, is, she's seen in a lot of her work in electrophysiology that right hemisphere auditory cortex like definitely represents language stuff, for perception at least. And you know, that's really what we saw here too, is that like for language perception, right hemisphere, it was engaged in sort of semantic representation to the same kind of degree as left hemisphere.
Yeah. And so what do you, do you think that is, I feel like when I first saw your paper, that was what jumped out at me too. And I struggled with it briefly. And then I came to terms with it. It doesn't trouble my mental model anymore. How do you interpret it? How do you square it with the fact that aphasia only results from left hemisphere damage?
Yeah. So, I think there's a broader question of like how we square a lot of these results with the aphasia literature, which is difficult, right? Because the literature says that there's only kind of a small selection of areas that if you have damage to those areas, then it causes this loss of semantic information, right? Loss of like word meaning information. But we saw these like much broader, like big distributed things all across like prefrontal cortex, parietal cortex, whatever. This just really did not match what people had seen in the aphasia literature. Especially then for the right hemisphere as well, right? We see it all over the right hemisphere, and that again just didn't match. So I think of this in kind of two ways. So one is that, what we're showing here is kind of what types of information are correlated with activity in these voxels, right? So, if somebody is listening to a story and the story is talking about, the relationships between people and so on, and you're trying to process that information, then there's a bunch of voxels that become active. There's a bunch of, brain areas that become active that start to, turn on in the presence of this kind of social information. That doesn't necessarily mean that like those are the areas that, link the words that you're hearing to the meaning that you're hearing, right? Mm-hmm. They can be downstream of that. And I think most of them actually are downstream of that. They're involved in like some kind of cognition around this concept, but not necessarily like, just the process of like linking words to meaning, meanings of words together.
Linking is so critical here. Yeah.
Yeah. So we kind of can't disentangle that here. And I think that is probably one of the real kind of drivers of what people see in the aphasia literature. And I know this is a popular topic there. The other thing that I kind of point to in trying to square this with aphasia is the fact that we see quite a bit of like redundant representation across cortex, right? We don't see there's just, one patch of cortex that cares about the social information or one patch of cortex that cares about, I don't know, time words, for example. That's another category that we saw kind of pop out. It's actually, you have many patches that care about these things, right? Yeah. We have a whole kind of network for each of these kinds of concepts, kind of topics. So I think it's very plausible that, like, you know, even if these areas are really like causally involved in representing and processing that kind of information, that damaging some of them won't be sufficient to actually cause the deficits that you would see in aphasia.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I definitely agree with your interpretation. I mean, and I think I would put it like, you are really studying thought here, right? In a way, like, it's down, like, downstream of these links, right? So I think we think with both hemispheres, and you know, just because language, well, but the links are in the left hemisphere, right? So if you took a person with aphasia and did your study on them, like a severe receptive aphasia, maybe, I think you probably wouldn't see those semantic representations in the right hemisphere either, even though the right hemisphere would be intact, right? Because it would never get there, because the links, which are left lateralized, would not exist, and that would, and therefore you wouldn't be able to generate that, like, those semantic representations from the linguistic input, right? So I actually don't think it's inconsistent at all on second thought. Although, like, you know, before your paper came out, I think a lot of us kind of thought, oh yeah, the semantic representations left lateralized, but I don't know if I thought, I hope I didn't think that, because it would be silly. Because, you know, one thing that I know from working with people with aphasia is that they understand the world that they live in, right? They're not like walking around confused and not knowing what's going on.
Absolutely.
It's a language, I mean, it's a language deficit. And the only patients that don't understand the world around them are neurodegenerative patients who have bilateral damage. They're specifically, like, semantic dementia, like, when it's advanced, or, you know, Alzheimer's when it's advanced, right? But, like, any kind of lateralized brain damage, you don't really get real semantic deficits. Like, you get, like, semantic control deficits. They can't do semantic tasks, maybe, for a myriad of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you never get somebody that doesn't understand what's going on. So it actually makes total sense.
It does.
It's nice to kind of square it. Because, yeah, it definitely, like, struck me. That was the thing that really leapt out at me, was how bilateral it was and symmetrical.
Yeah. So it's definitely symmetrical in terms of what we've been talking about, of just, like, you know, how well can we predict these areas. But it turns out that it's actually not super symmetrical in terms of exactly what information is represented there.
Oh, really?
So we see a little bit of a hint of that in this 2016 paper, where there's an asymmetry in terms of representation of specifically, like, concrete words, concrete concepts that seem to be more left lateralized than right lateralized. So it's like the representations are as strong in a way, but they're just kind of different things. In more recent work that we have yet to publish, but we're very excited about, which is doing a similar kind of thing like we did in this paper, but using, you know, more modern, like, language models. So we're looking at sort of phrase representations instead of word representations. We see that this asymmetry is really pronounced in terms of sort of representational timescale, where the right hemisphere seems to represent a sort of longer timescale information than the left hemisphere.
That's interesting.
Is maybe tied into this, like, concrete abstract distinction, which is also sort of associated with timescale. Huh. Yeah, this is my student, Shaylee Jane, who's working on this. We're very excited about what this is going to show.
Okay, cool. Yeah, actually, the next one I want to talk about is one by her, but not the one you're mentioning, I think. But yeah, one more thing about this one before you move on from, well, two more things, actually. So the lateralization might have come as a surprise to language people. But within each hemisphere, the areas that where you see the semantic predictability match pretty well onto what the language neuroscience community had kind of settled on as the semantic network of the brain, right?
Absolutely, yeah. No, I really love this. I think it's a 2009 review paper from Jeff Binder.
Yeah,
it's where is the semantic system?
One of the most useful papers that I go back to again and again. I just love
Same.
That one.
It's beautiful. I love how they break down, you know, the different types of experiments and you know, what kind of approaches they like and don't like. But there's a figure there that I, you know, I often show in talks, which is it's just a brain with little dots on it in every place that's been reported as, like, an activation in some paper for some semantic task. And it matches so well what mm-hmm. we find in this work, right?
It does.
The entire prefrontal cortex, the entire kind of parietotemporal cortex. I often say that this is kind of
and midline areas too, you know? You have the same midline areas. Like you both have like, you know, you've got your medial prefrontal and then you have precuneus and not in the middle and not, yeah, like it's not obvious at first glance because you guys use flat maps, right? So everything is like kind of flattened out, like because you're at, you know, this is the way you can tell you grew up in vision because like
exactly
you present flat maps. But as soon as you like just take a step back, you realize, oh, that's just the semantic network.
Exactly. I don't know. Sometimes I say it's like it's easier to say the parts of the brain that don't represent semantic information, which is like somatomotor cortex and visual cortex. Like those are the big ones. There's like two big holes in this map. Everything else kind of cares to, you know, some degree or another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Oh yeah. The other thing I wanted to talk to you about this paper, like, you know, it's just like a masterpiece of visualization among everything else, right? Like it's just so, the figures are so beautiful and you've got all these like, you've got all these three-dimensional animations that can be found on the web. Can you kind of talk about that aspect of it? Like, is that something you really enjoy? Like what kind of, how did you develop those skills? Like, you know, there's definitely a piece there that's like pretty special.
Yeah. Yeah. I love it. I love visualization. I think partway through writing this paper, I went to a seminar, like an Edward Tufte seminar. And so I started trying to do everything in Tufte style, whatever. I love it. I love his idea of, what do you call it? Like, super graphics, super infographics, like something that's just like incredibly dense with information that you can stare at for a long time and you keep seeing new stuff. I really like that idea. And so that's what I kind of tried to replicate here. So a lot of this work is really based on the visualizations are based on a software package that we developed in Jack's lab, PyCortex. So this is really led by James Gao, who was a grad student there with me. Brilliant programmer, like polymath. He can do so many things. So, he's a neuroscientist, but then he's also, able to write this very, massive amounts of low-level code for, showing these brain images in a web browser. Really just like fantastic stuff. So I worked with James on developing this PyCortex package and a couple other people in the lab, especially Mark Lesquois was a big driver of this as well. Because we were also developing the visualization package alongside like doing the science, we could make it do anything that we wanted to do, right? Like any idea that we had, like we should make it look like this. We can just do that. We could like, spend some time and implement that. So I really liked the sort of close commingling of those two things, of like developing the visualization software and the science at the same time. And I think that's, I think it's nice. I think it's powerful.
Yeah, it's very powerful. I mean, because the data is so multidimensional, right? And like, if you can't really use conventional, if you try to display it with conventional tools, you're not going to be able to convey it. It's so funny that you mentioned Tufte, right? Because like, I love Tufte as well. Like my wife, actually, she's a librarian and I think she introduced me to Tufte a long time ago. Like she gave me a Tufte book for Christmas, probably 15 years ago. It's The Visual Display of Quantitative Information. You probably have read it.
Wonderful book. Wonderful book. Yeah, I read that in college. My roommate got it and I was like, this is cool.
Yeah, so she gave it to me for Christmas and I was just like transfixed by it. I spent the rest of the holiday reading it and studying it. And I just went back to my work so invigorated. And I worked on this paper. It was a 2009 paper in neuroimage about support vector predicting PPA subtypes. But all the visualizations, like I was now like really inspired by this Tufte book and I like spent a lot of time on those figures and like thinking, how would Tufte make this figure?
So nice.
That's cool. You guys use Python. Like what do you have like a, what other kind of technical infrastructure do you use for developing your stuff?
Yeah. So, it's mostly Python, but, a lot of the visualization is actually done, in the web browser, like through JavaScript. So this was, back in like 2013, maybe, James had been working on PyCortex for a little while. And we were trying to figure out, like, we were trying to move away from Mojave, which is like a 3D display library that is very powerful, but also like very clunky and like hard to use in a lot of ways. And, you know, I said, like, let's make a standalone, you know, like 3D application that you can run on your computer, you know, in Python, whatever. And James said, no, let's do it in the browser. Let's like actually send information to the browser. And I was like, that's crazy. That seems really hard. Like, why would we do that? And he completely ignored me, which was like 100% the right thing to do. And he, you know, wrote this thing that, you know, was Python interacting with the browser and I don't know, tens of thousands of lines of JavaScript code to, you know, display these brain images. But it's just fantastic. So you can interact with the brain images in all kinds of fun ways. We could build these like interactive viewers like we have for this paper where, you know, you can click on different parts of the brain and it'll show you exactly what that little piece of brain is doing. So I think that was a really big part of it, is like getting it all to work in the browser, because then it's also very easy to share with
other people. It's transportable. Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Like it's funny, in my lab, we're also developing this portal into our aphasia data, which is not released yet, but we've been working on it for a while. And just like you, I was like originally envisaging a standalone application. And I was telling the SLPs in my lab who collect all this data, like, oh, this is what I want to do. I want to like have an application, you know, you'll install it on your computer and then you can look at our data. And they just looked at me like, what's wrong with you? You know, like, you'd have to install an application, like what, you know, download, how would you, you know, what is that even?
What is this,
like,
the 90s?
Yeah. And they convinced me to do it in the web. And yeah, like that's what we've done. And it's now built in JavaScript and it's going to be a lot more accessible as a result.
Nice. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, cool. So let's move on to the next paper if we can.
Beautiful.
This is by Shaylee Jane and yourself from 2018. Mm-hmm. Called Incorporating Context into Language Encoding Models for fMRI. I think it's an underappreciated paper. I mean, it's got like a bunch of citations, but I hadn't seen it before. It's published in a CS
conference. Yeah, Neurips.
Conference. But very interesting, because I think it's like the first fMRI fMRI encoding paper that like actually takes context into account and goes beyond the word level, right? Is that right? I don't think there's anything previous.
I think so. There had been one CS
a MEG
paper.
Study by Lila Wabe. A few.
Yeah.
But that's MEG.
Yeah. So yeah. Lila had done this in MEG in like 2014. Lila is now like a close collaborator of our lab. We do a lot of work together on this kind of stuff. There was one other like CS conference paper, I think from like the year before, that it was a little bit messy. The results were kind of mixed. But yeah, I think we were, you know, at least one of the first to really use these neural network language models, which were new and exciting at the time. So this is actually the first paper out of my lab. Like Shaylee was my first grad student. This was her first project in the lab. It was to, you know, try out these new things, which are neural network language models. Like, let's see what they do. We've been doing everything with these like word embedding vectors before that, which are great. They're beautiful. You know, you can reason about them in really nice ways. You know, you can interpret them in nice ways. But of course, they, you know, they're just words, right? You're predicting, you know, the brain response to somebody telling a story, but you're just actually individually predicting the response to each word and saying that like the response to this story is the sum of the responses to the words, which is just obviously blatantly false, right? Those models couldn't capture the kind of richness of language.
Mm-hmm.
So this was right at the time when language models were starting to become exciting in the computer science, like natural language processing world, right around when, you know, these first language models, Elmo and BERT, came out. So this is the days of like Sesame Street language models, which people had found were really interestingly useful, that if you just train this neural network to like predict what the next word is in a piece of text, or predict like a random masked out word from a piece of text, then it's kind of forced to learn a lot of interesting stuff about how language works.
Yeah.
Right?
Can we just like flesh that out a little bit? Cause this is so fundamental to all this work. And
yeah.
I think everybody's heard of ChatGPT and so on, but I don't know how many of us sort of understand that how much the fundamental technology is built on this concept of predicting the next word. So can you like just kind of try and explain that in a little more detail, like what these models, what's their input, not that much detail, obviously it's a podcast, not a CS paper,
so
what's the input, what's the output, and then I guess why does what's the architecture?
Yeah, so it's pretty simple. You have a big corpus of text, right? So like documents that are thousands of words long, potentially, say all of Wikipedia, for example, that's what we use to train some of these models. You feed the model the words one by one. It reads the words. And at every step, every time you feed it a word, you ask it to guess what the next word is. And it guesses like a probability distribution across, you know, all the words of like what it thinks the next word might be. In these early models, we used recurrent neural networks, these specifically LSTMs, long short-term memory networks, which were pretty popular as language models at the time. So this network kind of, you know, you feed it words one at a time, and it keeps its state, right? So what it will sort of produce, what it computes at each time step, is a function of like what the word was that came in and what its state was at the previous time step. Mm-hmm. Right, so it combines those two things to try to guess what the next word is going to be. So this seems kind of elementary, right? It's pretty simple. You just, you know, guess what the next word is. But it, you know, what turned out to be really cool about this and why people were so excited about this in the natural language processing world was, you know, that in order to do this effectively, in order to guess the next word accurately, you need to do a lot of stuff. You need to know how syntax works. You need to know about parts of speech. You need to know a lot about how semantics works, right? You need to know like which words go together. You know,
and what are representations of the individual words here? Because you still have to vectorize the individual words, right?
Yeah. So, in this model, there's a word embedding layer that's like the initial thing. So we go from a vocabulary of, I don't know, 10,000 words down to like a 400 dimensional vector. And embedding is also learned as a part of this model.
How does it learn that?
Backpropagation. It's the key to all this. So, you know, you start off with the words being one hot vectors. That's actually a lie. Let me back up. You start off with assigning a random embedding vector for each word.
Oh, okay.
And then those embedding parameters, just like the values in that embedding, you can compute a gradient. You compute this derivative that's like, you know, you take the loss at the end of the model, which is, you know, how wrong was it in predicting the next word? And then you just take the derivative of that loss with respect to these embedding parameters. Mm-hmm. And then you use that to, you know, change the embedding parameters a little bit, and you keep doing this for thousands and thousands of steps, and it learns these word embeddings. It learns like very effective word embeddings.
Okay, I didn't understand that. I had thought that you still had to kind of put in like a kind of an old school like word embedding as the first step, but you're saying that's actually part of the whole architecture. That kind of just comes out from the same algorithm that gives you the sensitivity to parsed words is also developing the representation to each individual word. Okay, I didn't understand that before.
Yeah. In the early days, a lot of people did this where they initialized with preset word embeddings. But it was found pretty quickly that as long as you have sufficient data to train the model, things work much better if you like train the word embeddings at the same time as the rest of the model.
Okay. Yeah. So just, I'm sure you've looked at this, and I don't know if it's in any of your papers, but it probably is. But like, if you use the kind of, just getting away from the contextual aspect of this paper, if you use word embeddings that are derived in this way, does that work much better than the sort of ones that you use in your 2016 Nature paper? Or does it work much the same?
It's about the same. They end up being actually very similar in a lot of ways. It's interesting. There are like a bunch of different ways of generating word embeddings. I could geek out about this for a long time, but the very old school word embeddings, like latent semantic analysis, are generated by looking at how words co-occur across documents. The newer things like Word2Vec and Glove are also looking at word co-occurrence. Word2Vec is actually like a neural network model that's trained to do this. Glove is just a statistical thing. The word embeddings that we used in my 2016 paper were a bespoke thing that I came up with, but that capture really the same kind of thing, right? It was just using kind of predefined dimensions instead of these like learned dimensions. Mm-hmm. And the word embeddings that you get out of neural network models are super similar. Like they act very similar because they're kind of just capturing the same thing, which is
right. So co-occurrence is a big part of it, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. So now I understand better. So you have random representations of the words that are learned to become differentiated, kind of based on co-occurrence to represent the semantics of the individual words. And then you've got hidden layers that are representing previous words that have been seen? Like, what kind of range do you look at in this paper? Like, how far back can it look?
Yeah, I think we looked back only like 20 words here. So yeah, we're manipulating like how many words go into the model, like how many words of context does it see before the current word. And what we found is that basically like the more words we feed in, the better it gets, right? As we, you know, as it sort of sees more context, the representations are better matched to whatever's happening in the brain. Our model predictions get better. So we could use this to kind of like look at, in a coarse way, context sensitivity across cortex, like which parts of cortex, you know, really, you know, are affected by, you know, information 20 words back, and which ones maybe only care about like what the most recent word is. So there we see kind of things that we'd expect to see, like auditory cortex only cares about the current word for the most part, right? It's mostly caring about like the sound of the word. So that's not unexpected. Whereas areas like precuneus, TPJ, really care more about like, you know, what happened a while back, or maybe some integration of information across a couple dozen words.
Right. Yeah. So you can kind of map out the language the semantic network, I guess I'd say, in terms of how deep it is and like how sort of contextually dependent it is, like going from single words to longer strings. These models are outperforming the single word models pretty much throughout the brain, right?
Yeah, very handily, which was very like, that was just a central exciting result to us, right? That we'd had these word embeddings. Honestly, our word embedding models had been fixed since I think 2013 at that point. So it was like 5 years of just messing with word embeddings and finding nothing that worked better, right? We tried like 1,000 different variations of word embeddings and like nothing actually like, worked
I guess
better.
My previous question, you just had basically told me like, yeah, these state-of-the-art single word representations don't really do better than your bespoke ones from the 2016 paper. So yeah, that wasn't really an avenue for improvement, but this is.
Yeah. But this like instantly was just better. It was like head and shoulders better than the word embeddings.
Yeah.
So that was really exciting, right? This was the first time that we were getting getting at representations of longer term meaning, which is something that of course, you know, we want to look at in the brain.
And combinatorial meaning, presumably. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's getting more and more language. Like as you go a lot further and further, you're getting more and more language, you know?
Exactly. And it keeps working better at predicting the brain, right?
Yeah.
So you make that number go up.
Not surprising. Yeah. So this is a very cool paper showing, you know, the how much you gain by adding context.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of funny. I think it's like kind of known to people in our like little fields, but most neuroscientists don't read the ACS conference papers, so I think a lot of people just like haven't seen it.
No, it has plenty of, like I said, it has plenty of citations, like well over 100, but like I don't think that, I mean, I hadn't seen it until I started like, you know, looking in more depth to so that I could talk to you. That's a shame because it's really good. So let's move now to a paper that is not currently published, but will be published by the time people hear this podcast. Mm-hmm. This is Tang et al. And by the time you hear this, it will be just out in Nature Neuroscience. A super cool paper. Can you tell me about what you've done in this one?
Yeah. So this is our decoding paper. So this is... we're no longer focused on encoding, on just trying to predict how the brain responds to language. We're now trying to reverse that, right? To take the brain responses and turn that into like, what were the words that the person was hearing? Right?
Okay. So you're reading minds, basically.
We try to avoid that term, but yeah, you know, same idea. So our approach here is really, it's driven by things that were done back in Jack Allen's lab. So Shinji Nishimoto, in particular, who'd done this like video decoding work, he developed this whole framework for he and some other folks there, Thomas Nazalaris and Kendra Kay in particular, they developed this framework for how do you turn an encoding model into a decoding model, right? We know how to build these very good encoding models, but you know, if you want to do decoding, if you want to figure out like what was the stimulus from the brain activity, how do you do that? And just if you fit a direct decoding model where you like just try to, you know, do regression in the opposite direction, you know, so take the brain data as your input and your stimulus as the output, that ends up to not work or be like very difficult in a number of ways. Mostly to do with sort of statistical dependence between things in the stimulus. Like if you're predicting multiple stimulus features, you're not predicting them in a way that actually respects like the covariance between those features. And that ends up being pretty important for getting this stuff to work. So in this paper, we use this kind of Bayesian decoding framework that they developed. And the basic idea is you just kind of guess. So we guess, like, what might the stimulus be? What words might the person have heard? And then we can check how good that guess is by using our encoding model. So in this paper, we had, you know, this we've had a couple years of advancement in language models, just an insanely rapidly developing field right now. When we started work on this decoding stuff, we were using GPT, like the original OG GPT from 2018, 2019. And that's what we ended up like, that's in the published paper. Of course, there's, you know, things have changed a lot in the intervening years, but it still is good enough for this to work. So these GPT-based encoding models, it works terribly well. It's doing more or less the same thing as the language models in Shaley's paper. In fact, she developed these GPT encoding models.
Can we just pause and get a little detail on that? So, you know, everybody's heard of ChatGPT, but can you sort of explain, like, A, what does it stand for? And B, how does it differ from, like, what's the crucial difference between that and the long short-term memory models that you used in the 2018 paper?
Yeah, so GPT is a generative pre-trained transformer. That was its original moniker. And the basic idea is it's using this different architecture. So it's no longer using a recurrent neural network. It's using a network called a transformer that was invented in 2017.
By Google, right?
Ashish Vaswani, who was actually an author on Layla's RNN predicting MEG paper back in 2014, which is an interesting whatever detail. or he was like one of the authors on the original transformer paper too. So transformers, they use very different mechanisms than recurrent neural networks. They use what we call an attention mechanism, a self-attention mechanism, where essentially to, you know, try to build up some representation of each word or each token in an input, the model can like attend across its inputs, attend across its context. So it can pick out, you know, information from many words that have come before and use that to you know, inform what it's doing right now. And, you know, what's really different about this compared to recurrent neural networks is that transformers don't have the kind of limited memory capacity that RNNs have. And I think that's really one of the fundamental things that makes them work so darn well for so many things. You know, the recurrent neural network, you feed it one word at a time, and then it has to pack information into its internal state. So it maybe has like 1,000 dimensions of like internal state, right? That are like, that's its entire memory. That's like everything it knows is in those 1,000 dimensions. Uh-huh. And, you know, if you feed it hundreds of words, it has to, you know, if it wants to remember something about those hundreds of words, it has to pack it all into that 1,000 dimensional vector.
Right.
Which is hard to do. It's hard to do. Yep. And especially because the kind of supervisory signals at long ranges end up being very sparse in language. Like it's rare for something 200 words ago to really influence like what the next word is in a piece of text. It's very important when it does, but it's pretty rare. Mm-hmm. So that ends up being kind of too weak a signal for RNNs to really pick up on it. But these transformer models, they can just kind of arbitrarily look back. They can say like, you know, what from anything in my past was relevant to this thing that I'm looking at right now, and then just pick that thing out and use it. And that means that it doesn't have this limited capacity. In the same way, it has a like much greater memory capacity, working memory capacity, effectively, which just makes it like incredibly powerful at doing these things. There's also other reasons why transformers have kind of taken over this world now. They end up being extremely efficient to train and run on our current GPU hardware, which is kind of like a weird reason why this model will be very good, but it's a, you know, a technical reason why people could train much bigger transformer models much more effectively than like big RNN models. Uh-huh. So they've really like taken over this world now.
Okay. Oh, that was really useful.
I teach a class on neural networks in the computer science department here. I just finished that like last week. Last module was on transformers, which was a lot of fun. So we talked about how transformers work.
Okay. I'd like to audit that.
It's fun. It's a fun class. Yeah.
Yeah, I bet. Okay. So let's talk. Yeah. Let's get back to your study. So, you know, how you're using using GPT models instead of the RNNs. You were telling me about the challenges of encoding rather than decoding, right?
Yeah. So we replaced the RNNs with these GPT models, the transformer-based models. Again, we get a big boost in encoding performance. We can predict the brain much better. But now what we're going to do is try to reverse this, do the decoding. So we're using this Bayesian decoding approach where essentially we're just guessing sequences of words. And then for any guessed sequence, we can use our encoding model to say how well does this match the actual brain data that we see? Right. So we guess a sequence of words, we predict how the brain would respond to that sequence of words, and then we compare that prediction to the actual brain response that we observe.
Yep.
This is kind of the core loop in this method. And
that's called a beam search algorithm, right?
Yeah. So beam search is really we keep multiple guesses sort of active at a time. We guess what's the next word in each of these multiple guesses, and then we throw out the worst ones. But we keep this sort of active set of, 20 to 100 different current hypotheses for what the text was that we're trying to decode. This ends up being kind of important because it helps us correct for the sluggishness of the hemodynamic response function, which is one of the real challenges in doing this kind of decoding, right? Mm-hmm. So we're trying to pick out the language that somebody is hearing. Lots of words happen in language, right? Words can happen pretty quickly. And with fMRI, one snapshot brain image is, summing across 20, 30 words, maybe if somebody's speaking at a pretty rapid clip.
Yeah.
Doing this beam search where we have multiple hypotheses. So that means the model can make a mistake and then kind of go back and correct it, right? Because it's not locked into one, best guess. That ends up being really important for being able to, correct for the fact that it has this slow sort of information that it can guess something at first and then see later information that can make it sort of update what happened before.
Right. I'm just trying to think about how to understand, to make all this clear. Can we talk about the sort of structure of the experiment? Because I think it will really help to understand what the participants do and then, what the task that you set yourself in terms of decoding their brains, and then I think the mechanisms will then make more sense. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. So the basic experiment that we do is just the same that we've been doing before. We have people lay in the scanner and listen to podcasts, right? Mostly the moth still.
You really should have them listen to the Language Neuroscience podcast.
That would be good.
I think it would work a lot better. In this one, you've got them doing it for 16 hours, right?
Yeah. That's
a lot of data.
We're making bigger data sets, which ends up being really important when we're looking at something high level like semantics, right? So, if we were just trying to build models of phonetic representation, there's only 40 phonemes in English. You can hear them in many combinations, but you only need sort of so much variability in your data to kind of map out, phonetic representation. Timit is great for this, right? The Timit corpus. It's every phoneme in many different combinations. You can get good stuff from Timit. And this is what Eddie Chang's lab does a lot of. But there's a lot more different kinds of semantics, right? There's a lot more different kinds of ideas that can be expressed. You can think a lot of different kinds of thoughts, right? Mm-hmm. So to kind of map this out in detail, you need to go much deeper. You need to go much broader in terms of what you look at. So that's why we just keep adding more data. In this case, we had people come back more than a dozen times over the course of months. We just keep scanning them over and over again, each time listening to new stories, different stories, right? So we see different aspects of these ideas and how they're represented in these people's brains. What we find is that encoding model performance really relies on the amount of data, especially for these semantic encoding models. As you increase the amount of data, it just keeps getting better. The same for this decoding performance. So just keeps getting better as we add more data. But so, we have this ton of data of people listening to stories. We can build our encoding models. That's well and good. Our initial tests of the decoder were basically just we had somebody, listen to a story that's our test story that we use for, predicting brain responses. And we just try to decode the words in that story instead of, predict the brain responses to that story. And eventually through like, you know, quite a bit of trial and error and, you know, figuring out what were the important aspects here, we got that to work pretty well. We were, you know, pretty excited by this. It was, you know, it started spitting out, you know, not like exactly the words in the story, but like a pretty decent paraphrase of what the words in the story were.
Okay. So just to make it clear, you train them on like 16 hours of data, build these models, and then you take like, let's say 10 minutes of data. I don't know exactly how much it is, but something smaller.
Exactly. Yeah, 10.
And you then basically feed the model the brain data from the person listening to this unseen story, and you try and get the model to generate what the story was that the person heard, right?
Yes.
That's, yeah. So in other words, the only way that's going to work is if you're, I know you hate to use the phrase, but like if you're, you have to read their mind because the model has no access to what story they were played. So the only way the model's going to know the story is by reading their mind.
Well, it's a reading their brain. Like we don't know where the mind is. It's somewhere
it's,
in there.
It's the brain.
We're definitely reading what's happening in the brain. Yeah.
The mind. It's the brain, as you
it's
know.
The brain. Yeah.
It's the same thing. Okay. So yeah, that so it starts. You have some success with that.
Yeah, yeah. So there was kind of a startling moment. I think this was during the pandemic. We're all like working at home, and Jerry showed me some results that were like, "Oh my god, this works. This is like giving us things that sound like the story. It's actually, you know, pretty accurate at this point." And this is very exciting to us, right? So you know, we can now decode a story that somebody is hearing. Right, which is kind of step one. Like that's interesting by itself, but that's not even really potentially that useful. So at that point, we went back and did some follow up experiments. So we took the same subjects that we'd been scanning.
Well, hang on. Can we like talk about that result from your paper? Can we kind of just share it with our listeners?
Absolutely.
Like we're talking figure one here, right?
Yes.
Okay. So you're saying it's not that interesting. I think it's very interesting. Okay, I'm going to say the actual stimulus that the subject heard, and you're going to tell me the decoded stimulus that your model produced based on reading their mind, or whatever you want to call it. Okay. I got up from the air mattress and pressed my face against the glass of the bedroom window, expecting to see eyes staring back at me, but instead finding only darkness.
I just continued to walk up to the window and open the glass. I stood on my toes and peered out. I didn't see anything, and looked up again. I saw nothing.
Wow. Okay, let's do some more. This is good. I didn't know whether to scream or cry or run away. Instead, I said, "Leave me alone. I don't need your help." Adam disappeared and I cleaned up alone, crying.
Started to scream and cry, and then she just said, "I told you to leave me alone. You can't hurt me. I'm sorry." And then he stormed off. I thought he had left. I started to cry.
Let's do one more. That night, I went upstairs to what had been our bedroom, and not knowing what else to do, I turned out the lights and lay down on the floor.
We got back to my dorm room. I had no idea where my bed was. I just assumed I would sleep on it, but instead, I lay down on the floor.
That's pretty amazing. You know?
Can we do the last one? The last one is okay. The one that like we always use as a demo.
Okay, the last one. I don't have my driver's license yet, and I just jumped out right when I needed to. And she says, "Well, why don't you come back to my house and I'll give you a ride?" I say, "Okay."
She's not ready. She has not even started to learn to drive yet. I had to push her out of the car. I said, "We will take her home now." And she agreed.
It's incredible.
Right? It actually works. We're getting this out of fMRI data. fMRI, which is like the worst of all neuroimaging methods, like except for all the other
except
ones.
Except that it's the best, yeah. Okay.
fMRI is like awful in so many ways. And yet, you know, we're getting out like, it's not word for word. In fact, the word error rate is god awful, right? Sorry, my dog is excited about something. You know, the word error rate is like 94% here. It's not getting the exact words for the most part,
sure.
But it's getting the gist, right?
It's often getting
like
the gist.
Paraphrase.
Yeah, and you have some, you know, some kind of intuitive ways of quantifying how well it's doing that don't rely on it being word for word match, and it's all quite intuitive and explained well in the paper.
Yeah, yeah. So this was, I mean, very exciting when we saw this. You know, we could read out. You know, the story that somebody was hearing, and kind of the fact that it was a paraphrase was also interesting to us, that it's like, you know, we're not getting it. It really seems like some low level representation.
No.
We're getting it something high level, right?
And you wouldn't with fMRI, right? Like, I mean, like maybe with Eddie Chang's data, you could read the phonemes and get it that way.
Right.
But you can't, which they do beautifully. You're never going to be able to do that with fMRI.
Yeah. But the ideas, right? Like what's the thought behind this sentence? That probably like changes slowly enough that we can see it and kind of isolate it with fMRI, right? Exactly. The individual words, they're all mashed up. That's a mess. But you know, each idea kind of evolves over a few seconds, and that's something that we have a hope of pulling out with fMRI.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So very cool. And then you take it in a lot of other directions from there. Which one should we talk about? Let's talk about, okay, do you need the whole brain to do this, or can you do this with just parts of the brain?
Yeah. So this was a fun analysis. And I think one of the more like scientifically interesting kind of parts of this paper. So Jerry tried doing this decoding with, for the most part, we're just using voxels from all over the brain, like whatever seemed kind of useful for doing this. We have some criteria that are detailed, but it's parts of prefrontal cortex, parts of parietal, temporal cortex, speech network, whatever. It's everywhere, both hemispheres. But we asked, like, you know, what if we only use prefrontal cortex? What if we only use like temporoparietal association areas? What if we only use the speech network? What if we only use the right hemisphere? What if we only use the left hemisphere? Like, how well does this work? So generally what we see is that, performance is degraded if we don't use all of the data that we have, which I think is not terribly surprising that, we're just getting kind of more signals if we use more parts of the brain, but it's degraded kind of uniformly. So it's not like we're getting one kind of thing out of each brain area. It seems pretty redundant, like, how well we're able to decode from each brain area ends up being like very correlated. Right hemisphere, left hemisphere, prefrontal cortex, temporoparietal cortex, all of these seem to be carrying like very similar information, at least in terms of like what we're decoding here. So that was exciting to us as like a, as a scientific demonstration of like, kind of proof of redundancy to some degree across these areas. But then also in terms of kind of practical applications of this kind of technology, that means that, even if somebody has, say, damage to one of these regions, or if only some of these regions are accessible to some, neuroimaging technology, because, if somebody uses a decoder like this to do something, it's probably not going to be fMRI for some practical purpose, then it doesn't need to see the whole brain. It could only see, like, some part of it and still be quite effective.
Yeah, it's definitely got that sort of practical application. And I do think it reinforces the what you mentioned earlier, like the redundancy of these semantic representations. I mean, I would quibble, one of the networks you look at is like what you call a language network. And to me, it's like, I don't remember exactly how you localized it, but it seems a little low level. It's getting like, it looks like it's got like, STG rather than STS, for instance. So, I don't think it matters terribly much what the networks are. It's just maybe the main fact is that like you can take any small piece of the whole thing and get pretty good performance.
Yeah. Especially that it's like, right hemisphere too. So this is even, I think, more proof positive that right hemisphere is it's actually doing things.
Well, it's maybe representing it's not, thoughts. Like, I mean,
Yeah.
I mean, again, let's do a thought experiment. Like if it was a person with aphasia, yeah, I bet you wouldn't get it in the right hemisphere, even if the right hemisphere is intact, right? Because it would never get there from the auditory story. But more relevant to your actual future application, person with aphasia is thinking with their intact right hemisphere and having thoughts that are fully formed and normal in their intact right hemisphere, and you can read those off and produce language from them, right?
Yeah.
It wouldn't work on the input side. Which is fine, because maybe it's not fine, but like
it would be hard to train the model in that case.
Would it though? That raises the question of to what extent can you do this with cross training? Like, can you train it on somebody other than the individual that you're using it on?
The answer to that is currently like definitely no. We can't do that. So we tested that as sort of one of the after we got these results. Can we take a step back before we talk about this part?
Yeah.
So, in addition to the to the listening to stories, we tested a couple other things. So we tested we had subjects go in the scanner and tell stories in their heads,
Mm-hmm.
So the way this actually worked is, you know, we had people memorize like 1 minute segments of stories, not like memorize them word for word, but, you know, practice retelling them in their own words a bunch of times. We recorded them like telling these 1 minute segments of stories. And then we immediately stuck them in the scanner and had them do exactly the same task where they were, you know, telling these stories, just not out loud. So just do it in your head without saying the words out loud. We put that data into our decoder. And what we got was, you know, a little bit less good than what we had for the language perception, but was still like pretty clearly related to the content of the story, right? It was still like a decent paraphrase of like the story that they were telling in their heads. So this was kind of the clincher. This is like the, you know, there's actually, you know, thoughts happening here that a person is not expressing, that we are, you know, reading out the brain activity related to those thoughts and turning that into words, right? This is the real deal.
No, it's super cool. I guess for me, like, because I always interpret your work as mostly showing thought rather than language per se, it doesn't surprise me when you make that next step, right? Like once I'd seen it read off the one that we did kind of together out loud a few minutes ago, once I'd seen that, I was like, well, yeah, that'll work for like, you know, production as well. And it did. But I can see how that's actually a pretty big step.
Yeah. So when we saw that, that actually got a little scary. We were like, this is to the level of being like, you know, this makes us a little nervous. Like this is a bit freaky what's happening here. So Jerry went off and did a ton of reading on kind of mental privacy and neuroethics and what people are saying about this. Like what are the things that people are concerned about? What are kind of the categories of things that people care about in this area? And he designed a set of experiments to kind of test these privacy concerns, right? So one of the first ones is what we started talking about a moment ago. Do you need the subject's cooperation? Do you need data from the subject to train the model, right? To like, you know, to get the training data to form the model in the first place. So to test that, we just tried to like map models from one subject to another. And we tried a bunch of different approaches for this. We did you know, anatomical mapping from one subject to another. We did functional cross mapping using, you know, some functional data from each subject. And it just didn't work. It just fundamentally didn't work. Even though like, you know, at a broad strokes, the, you know, the semantic maps are pretty similar across people.
Yeah.
Whatever this model is getting at, the, you know, what's making it able to pull out this, you know, pretty accurate representation of what the language is, that's got to be kind of buried in the details of these
right
maps.
Yeah, and I guess I think I forgot to ask you but I know that in your 2016 paper and the early one too, like one of the remarkable things was that these semantic maps were similar across participants in their actual specific layout of like which concepts were represented where. But you're saying like that, even though it's similar, it's not similar enough to work in this context where there's like several more layers of inferencing happening in between, right?
Yeah. That's right.
Mm. Okay.
So this was, you know, on the one hand, kind of like bad for practical applications because it means, you know, you need a ton of training data for someone to get this to work, but kind of good for mental privacy, right? This means that you can't just chuck someone an MRI scanner and read what they're thinking, right? Which is good. I think that's a good thing that's not something that just exists in the world. We tested some other kind of privacy questions. So
I mean, to be honest, like I think it might only be a temporary delay because I mean conceptually it's all there to read across minds. I think I'm not saying you need more data per se because you've pretty much got the max data, but or maybe I don't know, but like you know. The pieces are in place that you should be able to train it across subjects.
Yeah.
I mean, it's probably only technical limitations. Like,
I agree with that. Yeah, definitely. Maybe, you know, better anatomical MRI, some way of like, you know,
all right. Yeah. Maybe
areas from person to
yeah,
person.
Yeah. Like because you're just doing anatomical alignment, right? If you did some kind of functional based alignment, like
we tried functional alignment and that didn't work.
That didn't
either.
Help.
So at least like at the sort of course level that we were doing it, that didn't work. But certainly that is not to say that it cannot work. Right. And we say this actually in the end of the paper that like, you know, this particular thing, you know, this is probably a temporary problem for this model, right? Or, you know, only whatever. You know what I'm saying?
Yep. So you test, what do you call it? Resistance, conscious resistance.
Yeah. Yeah. So we tested, so do we need the subject's cooperation, to run the decoder, right? So to train it, we know that like we kind of do at least for now, but to actually like run the model to decode words from somebody's brain, like, do they need to be, you know, cooperating with this? So, for this, we had people, go in the scanner, listen to a story, but then we told them to do something else while they're listening to the story, right? Instead of trying to actively listen to the story, we had them try to like actively think something else, right? So we did like a mental math task, like count backwards by sevens, a task where we had people name as many animals as you can, or like try to tell a different story in your head. So one of these like imagined stories. And then we tried to, you know, decode from that. And it turned out that, at least especially for the naming animals and telling a different story conditions, the decoding was ruined. There's just like no information there, no usable information.
Was it above chance though?
It was above chance, but it's like, there's nothing that you can, you know, infer about that. Like the words just kind of don't make sense, or they don't hang together as part of the story. And they don't look like the thing that the person is trying to do either. It's like, it's not like we decode a bunch of animal names when they're trying to name animals. It seems like these things are interfering in some way that's just making it like not really get something out. The mental math task was not as effective, which I also found, kind of, you know, you can introspect on this, just try to do it in your mind, like count backwards by sevens, and eventually you get kind of good at it, and then you can start like listening to somebody talk while you're doing it.
Right.
And I think that's kind of what could happen here.
I mean, I've been counting back by sevens through our whole conversation. You didn't even notice.
Goodness, you're so good at it. But it was like the more semantic tasks, right? The like name animals that really did interfere.
Yeah. Okay. So I like it that you kind of like went straight to like wondering about the ethical implications of this. I mean, I think that when publishing a paper like this, it's good to start talking about that from the get-go.
Yeah, I thought so too. This was like really all Jerry's doing, I gotta say. Very clever person.
Yeah. Is he still in your lab or moved on?
Yeah, so he's a computer science grad student in my lab, graduating in, I don't know, about a year. This is really the bulk of his like thesis work here. And yeah,
it's awesome.
I'm very proud of him.
Looking forward to see what he does next. Yeah, very cool. Okay, well, we talked for a long time. I guess it's your evening.
Yeah, no, not so bad. It's a fun conversation.
Yeah, very much so. Really enjoyed like reviewing your work to talk to you and like hearing about it from you firsthand.
Thank you.
So, yeah, I haven't made a podcast for a while because I moved and things have been up in the air, but this was a really great one to get back to it with.
Awesome. Yeah. Thanks again so much for having me on. This was a lot of fun and I love talking about this stuff. I don't know.
Yeah.
I like that we could geek out about the little things too.
Oh, which yeah, for sure.
I don't often get to talk to people about like HRFs, you know?
Yeah, no, I think, well, that's the thing that's kind of, you know, unique about my podcast is it's not really for a general audience. Like most of the people are kind of doing science at some, and they know about these things and they're interested in them. So it's more like a conversation you might have at a conference than a conversation you'd have, you know, with a neighbor. Nice. Speaking of conferences, any chance you going to make it to France this year for SNL?
I'm planning on it. I was invited to give a talk at a symposium. I don't know if that symposium is accepted yet, but we'll see.
I hope so. It'd be great to see you there if you can make it.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd love to see you there. Are you, you're going to be there?
Yeah, I'm the program chair. So.
Oh, goodness. You're definitely going to be there. Yeah. Okay.
I have to be there. Will I be like, you know, having any headspace to do anything other than worry about, you know, PC and Mac connections to the audiovisual equipment? That I'm less sure about, but I will be there.
Yeah. Oh, God. I hate this. So I've, you know, been organizing some like workshops at computer science conferences for the past couple of years where we get sort of, you know, this intersection of neuroscience and computer science people. And it's like, it's the biggest bummer because it's the topics that I'm really excited about and I really want to hear these people talk, but then it's like your headspace is just wrong. When you're organizing, you're worried about so many other things and it just like doesn't work as well as just, you know, going and enjoying something.
Yeah, I think it's going to be like that, but... Yeah, I'm still looking forward to going to France.
yeah, it'll be nice.
Well, thank you very much. And I will hope to catch up with you soon.
Yeah, you bet, Stephen. Thanks again.
All right. Have a good morning. Take care. Bye.
You too.
Okay, well, that's it for episode 25. Thanks very much to Alex for coming on the podcast. I've linked to the papers we talked about in the show notes and on the podcast website at langneurosci.org/podcast. I'd like to thank Neurobiology of Language for supporting transcription and Marcia Pettit for transcribing this episode. Thanks for listening and see you next time.